This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello! Yep, still no Jeff. He's still in Mexico, but he will be back. Welcome to this week's Reasons to be Cheerful. And some of you may have heard about Veganuary, which is the trend towards trying to be vegan in January. I'm quite sort of interested in this. I'm totally failing to sort of observe it because I sort of caught on late, perhaps like many things. That's true. But I'm quite excited because Joel, the researcher on the podcast, you had not the vegan sausage roll, which has led to big bonuses for Greg's employees, but the steak bake. The trouble is you're briefing against the steak bake, aren't you?
I did indeed have a steak bake. It was very a lot of gravy, less steak, more just a kind of salty gravy mush. I wasn't impressed.
You're not a great advocate, and you are vegetarian, not vegan. You're vegan.
Yeah. So
Veganuary is like just so what to you?
Varch.
What? I've actually today just ordered the Bosch cookbook.
Yeah.
Because I raised this with my family last night, and I must say I was greeted with a degree of sort of derision. I mean, part of the problem is if you've got a 9 and a 10 year old and they don't really sort of eat any vegetables, then sort of going vegan, I think my sort of Justine is kind of quite skeptical that they'll be able to eat anything if they don't eat vegetables. But I was looking on the internet last night for, and maybe the listeners can help with this, with sort of vegan recipes for kids, you know, with the fact that these, you know, my kids, like, they don't eat lasagna, for example, for reasons that are sort of slightly beyond me. So they're kind of quite, you know, without briefing against them, you know, I love my children, they're not the sort of easiest eaters, I wouldn't say. I mean, I think they eat broccoli and like green beans are push, and maybe carrots. Were you vegan as a child?
No. You need to get them to watch the Okja. It's a film about a kind of dystopia in which a big multinational company kind of factory farms these weird pig things, and it's kind of these huge big pigs.
Right.
I think get them to watch that, and they'll be converts.
Wow. But then they still need to get onto the eating vegetables. You think that's the sort of necessity, force majeure, just eat the vegetables.
Yeah, that's kind of motivation.
Sorry, we turned this into Jeremy Paxman. We did a good episode on sort of flexitarianism, vegetarianism, veganism, but I'm just sort of declaring a kind of a strong interest in this, and I will keep people updated. And if you've got, please do email in if you've got good vegan recipes or vegetarian actually recipes for children which you think they'll like. And I think the stipulations are, you know, it can involve broccoli, can't involve peanuts because my son has got peanut allergy, one of my children's got peanut allergy. I think it needs to be not lots of stuff mushed together, but they don't seem to like things that sort of mix together, which I think is a children's thing. There's skepticism about cheese. They don't like mashed potato. I mean, honestly, it's a difficult situation. Anyway, I'm grateful for any advice that you've got. Now we've got a really exciting announcement, which isn't about the Greg's vegan steak bake. It is about our book club. It's been like a very, very long gestation period, but the book club is finally here this Thursday. Please do sign up to the feed. We've got a brilliant first episode, which is Jeff talking to Rana Faruha about her book Don't Be Evil, about how to take on the tech giants. You'll really want to listen to this episode. We've got great people coming up after that. Michael Lewis, Alex Beard on Natural Born Learners, Mariana Matsukato, great, really great authors, really interesting conversation, really interesting ideas about how to make the world a better place and about what their books are saying and how they came to write them. So please do sign up. You just on your normal podcast app, you just search Cheerful Book Club and it will be there. Now, back to the parent, if you like, Reasons to be Cheerful. This week we are talking about young people and young people being mobilized in the cause of social justice and campaigning. And this came about because I was approached on the tube last week by two young people, Olamide and Nico, and they handed me what looked like a copy of the Evening Standard, but it wasn't a copy of the Evening Standard. It was a copy of the Evening Standard with a wraparound of their campaigning around teaching people in schools about the empire, about consciousness, about racism, about a whole range of things. Anyway, I got into a fascinating chat with them. It turned out they were from the Advocacy Academy, which is an organization based in South London that trains young people in activism. They run a fantastic course for 16 to 18 year olds, teach them about campaigning, grassroots organizing, and direct action, and helping them to launch their own campaigns. And honestly, it's such an inspiring conversation you're about to hear. And I'm going to be talking to two young activists about their campaigns on teaching the history of empire in schools and challenging the criminalization of young people of color. And then to Amelia Viney, who's founder of the Advocacy Academy. And then we're turning to Greater Manchester and the Reclaim Project. They're supporting young people in activism in Greater Manchester with a specific focus on amplifying the voice of working class young people. And we're talking to one of their team and a young person who they have got mobilized into activism. And again, it's a great conversation, so I think you'll really enjoy it. My reason to be cheerful is also about activism, and it's about the decision by the private equity giant BlackRock, the world's biggest pension fund manager, to exit investments that present a high sustainability-related risk. And this has really been a big moment in the whole divestment campaign. This began as a pretty marginal campaign on student campuses to try and persuade colleges and universities in America to divest from fossil fuel companies. And it's been described by Bill McKibben, who also will feature on the Book Club podcast, very leading US climate activist, as a remarkable breakthrough. And in two letters on Monday of last week, the BlackRock boss Laurie Fink announced the evidence on climate risk is compelling investors to reassess core assumptions about modern finance, and henceforth the company would divest from coal-related businesses. And the announcement called on every company, not just any energy firms, to rethink their carbon footprints. This came after climate activists protested outside BlackRock's London offices last November, dumping ashes to signify the Amazon fires, while Extinction Rebellion, the global environmental movement, described BlackRock as the world's top investor in deforestation and coal. Now, before we all get too excited, they've divested from coal, but not from fossil fuel companies, and they currently hold a 6.7% stake in ExxonMobil and 6.9% in Chevron. So the next step is to get them to divest from fossil fuel companies as opposed to coal-related businesses. But it may be, as Bill McKibben says, a baby step, but it is still a step, and it shows that activism can have an impact.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
So as I said in the introduction, I was approached by Nico and Olamide and thought it sounded like a fantastic project. And I'm delighted to say that we have with us Rochelle Meaden from the Fill in the Blanks campaign and Seema Mangal from the IC Free campaign, and they are both graduates of Advocacy Academy. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
It's
so cool.
No, it's so cool for me. It's great that you're here. So I think, Rochelle, just tell us a little bit to begin with before we get on to Fill in the Blanks.
Yeah.
About how you got involved with the Advocacy Academy, what you do there, and so on. And then we'll talk about the campaign.
Yeah, so I found out about advocacy through Twitter, which is how I find out everything. So I remember just scrolling through my timeline and seeing a photo of a Harry Potter poster at bus stop, but except this time Hermione was black and had box braids. And I could have never seen myself represented in that way.
Wow.
So I was like, shit, I need to find out who made this.
And was that a bus stop?
Yeah, it was a photo. It was at a bus stop in Brixton, I think.
Wow.
And it was one of Advocacy's campaigns by a group called Legally Black. And then I found out about Advocacy, and I was like, this is something I really, really want to do, because I'd been so angry about all of the injustices in my life and the world around me. But I realised that instead of just sitting there and being a bit stroppy, they were actually doing something about it.
That's so brilliant. And just to explain to our listeners, you go to school, you're in year 12, so that's like what you do in the school, normal school day. And then how much, what's the time commitment with Advocacy Academy?
Lots of time.
Right.
Yeah, so every Friday, more or less from September to December, I trekked from Newham, which is where my school is, to Brixton. And then from like 5 to 10, 5 to 11, we would have Friday night gatherings. So half of them would be campaign coaching sessions where we'd work on our specific campaigns. And the other half of them would be just evenings, like just art, just criminals, where we'd look at a specific issue and dissect what it would mean if that issue, if there was actually justice for that issue.
How brilliant. I want to come and be a graduate. Right, Seema, tell us, how did you get involved in Advocacy Academy?
So I didn't actually have an assembly like most people did in advocacy. My politics teacher, who was involved in Advocacy Academy, had told me about it. She was like really adamant that I joined. She said it would be amazing. At first, I thought it was a political boot camp.
Yeah.
So that's what many of us thought when we were applying.
How would a political boot camp be different? What were your expectations then?
I was expecting us to sit down, go through the Labour Conservative manifesto, look at every single policy.
And would that be something similar to what you'd maybe done at school or
citizen? Yeah, in my politics lessons, yeah.
So more like politics lessons, yeah. And less like what you're doing.
Yeah.
We are going to get to your campaigns, but you do 400 hours of training. Give our listeners a sense of what a few of those hours would be like.
Yeah, so we will start off a Friday evening by having dinner together as a community and like listening to music in the background. And then with a just evening, we'll choose a particular issue to dissect. So I remember one of the ones we did was just news. So we got all of the newspapers from that day. And I think it was a day after Labour had announced a manifesto. So it was a good news day.
Yeah.
And we compared all of the different headlines and looked into what bias looks like in our media and how certain groups can be presented in a very negative light. I remember there was a really Islamophobic headline from one of the papers, right. I can't remember, and we had a discussion about it, and then we created our own headlines given like a scenario. I think the scenario was like, if a queen had died, how would like the Guardian report it, how would a Vice video report it, how would the Sun report it. So we use lots of creative activities like that. It's not like we just sit around being like, that's Capital, that's really not what we do.
That was my childhood. That's great. Seema, yeah, go on, to give us a bit more of a sense of...
After our just evenings, we would do a bit of campaign work where we'd regroup with our campaign members. We would look at like what we want to do in our actions. I mean, there was a lot of disagreement for sure, since especially in IC3 we had so many on what was the big action that we really wanted to put out there.
So that takes us absolutely to your campaign. So tell us, Seema, about your campaign, because when Olamide approached me, she talked to me about IC3. So tell us about that campaign and how it came about.
Yeah, so IC3 is a campaign run by myself and 5 other black and brown students. We aim to stop the criminalization of both the black and brown community in the criminal justice system and education institutions. In much more simpler words, we really want to put an end to racial profiling.
And IC3 is the label that the police give to black young people, yeah. Or everyone?
Black young people
when they're stopped and searched.
Yeah.
And the IC3 campaign is about the criminalisation of young people in the criminal justice system, but also about the way schools and colleges deal with people. Just say something about that.
So, yeah, IC3 is a campaign that's based off of the school-to-prison pipeline, where once a child is permanently excluded, they are forced into a lifestyle of gang and violence and crime, and therefore it leads to them being arrested and sent to prison. So it shows how, from a young age, schools are pushing children into these prison systems, and they're not offering the right fundamental support that these children do need.
So it's about police treatment of ethnic minority young people, but it's also about the school's treatment of them as well.
Yeah.
And so tell us about because it's interesting to hear the mechanism, how did you decide that was your campaign? And then what are you doing in terms of the campaign?
So I guess the campaign is based on our lived experiences. So I remember at the age of 15, I was arrested and I had called the police. I called them to protect me against a man who was being Islamophobic against me and my sister, and he was also threatening us with a knife.
In the street or?
Oh, no, no, in the corridor of the apartments.
Right, and you were arrested.
Yeah, the police arrived and they put me in metal cuffs, my sister in metal cuffs. My sister had fainted and they didn't care for her well-being. Instead, they dragged her across the floor till she stood up and they put us in police vans.
How awful.
Like, till this very day, we were in the cells from around 9 p.m. till 4 in the morning.
Oh my God.
And I can still remember, like, the blue thin mattresses and the blankets. Like, I felt dehumanized. I felt like my dignity had been stripped from me.
So what happened afterwards?
So I attended school the next day and my head of year only cared enough to ask whether or not I had committed the crime that I was arrested for.
Obviously, the police didn't ever do anything after
no,
that.
No, they just lined us up and told the guy to point fingers at who the police should arrest.
And then what happened? What actually happened with the case? They obviously didn't take a case against you.
No, they said it was a two-sided story.
Oh, my God.
So imagine putting a 15-year-old in a position where they had to sit in a holding cell in a dark room and feel like, you know, completely dehumanized.
Of course.
It's really sad. It really hurts a person and it really changes a person. It affects them mentally and physically.
Of course. So that came very much from your personal experience, the IC Free campaign. And then how do you go about sort of undertaking the campaign and what does it involve into advocacy?
So IC Free isn't just a campaign based on my experiences or like the other members' experiences. Yeah. So like Alex, who was coerced into a strip search at the age of 15, or Esther, who was stopped and searched on her way to basketball practice. I mean, it's more about the unheard voices of the black and brown community, like who have faced such hardships in these institutions. So, I mean, we've carried out two actions in December.
What were they?
So our first action is where we had made big metropolitan police posters where we put young black and brown kids in mugshots holding a placard that said the words like threat, suspect, aggressive. And on top, there were like quotes like black people were 3 times more likely to be tasered.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good. One good action. What was the other thing you did?
The second action was outside of Brixton Station, where we had created an isolation unit to show the treatment of students in isolation by teachers. And we had 6 tables and chairs and 6 students within the isolation unit, one of whom was sharing all the powerful stories that each IC Free member had experienced or friends and relatives who had negative experiences with these institutions.
Rochelle, tell us about your campaign, because this, the Nico sort of, as I was about to get on the tube, literally about to get on a train, Nico said, "Mr. Miliband, I've got something I want to show you." And the doors were about to close, and I took the paper, and then I thought, I'm not going to walk onto the tube. So I then had the conversation. It was a copy of a paper that looked like the Evening Standard, but it had a difference. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so I think you picked up a copy of the New Standard.
Yeah.
Which is part of a wider campaign that we pulled off on that day, where we distributed in total, I think, 5,000 papers, metros, not metros, and New Standards, claiming that Boris backed colonial education being mandatory. But what you saw was the very end of our action, because this whole campaign started 6 months ago, way back at the first Advocacy Academy residential, where me and 6 other black and brown students knew we were angry about this issue.
So this is like about learning about empire, the history of empire, mm-hmm. Britain's role, all of that stuff. We did a podcast episode about it in the summer. It was our favourite episode of last year because it opened my eyes, to be honest.
Yeah. So we decided that we were going to make these headlines and distribute all these papers. And we had to collect 5,000 metros and evening standards over, I think, like 6 or 7 weeks. And I think we really did not understand how big of a number 5,000 is.
Yeah.
We started off like carrying them in our hands and then it became bags for life. And then you have one evening when my dad drove like halfway across London with a boot full of newspapers.
Well done, your dad.
Yeah.
What's your dad's name?
David.
David, shout out to David. And then you put a front page and a back page. Go on.
Yeah, so we had to write, I think, 8 pages of copy in total. So the front page story and then supplementary stories and then reading lists. And then we managed to get an amazing graphic designer called Matt Bonner to help us. And then after we printed them all out, we turned the Advocacy Academy campus into a production line. So for two straight nights, we stapled and folded and bundled like 5,000 newspapers.
How brilliant. And then you handed them out. And we should say the campaign is called Fill in the Blanks.
Yeah.
What has been the reaction to your action?
I think the reaction has been really positive. And me and Iman, one of the other co-founders, were talking about this yesterday. We were like, I'm surprised anyone, like, we really didn't think people were going to care. But lots of people have had really positive reactions to it. My mum sent it to all my aunties because she's embarrassing. And some of my aunties came back saying, oh, this is so good. But they made the assumption that it was already on the curriculum and that all children had to learn about Empire anyway.
And let's go to that specific issue as well as about the action. I mean, how does this sort of fit in with your experience?
Yeah, so my history lessons were a bit of a car crash. Yeah, so I made the choice not to take GCSE history. Not because I wasn't good at it. Like, don't get me wrong. My essays on suffragettes in year 9 were banging.
I'm sure.
But because I knew I would never see myself represented in any sort of meaningful way, I didn't see the point in pursuing a subject where people who look like me weren't even deemed worthy enough to be on the curriculum. And when you have less black kids taking GCSE history and A-level history and then going to university to take history, you end up with a situation where 96.1% of UK historians are white. And also there's, I think the way that I was taught Empire specifically left me feeling really disempowered.
Were you taught it?
I was taught Empire. I think we had a unit in a very small unit in year 9 about Empire, but it was like 3 lessons.
Right.
And I remember being taught the transatlantic slave trade like very distinctly. My teacher began the lesson by saying that slavery has nothing to do with race. And then I remember by the end of the lesson being led to believe that Africa actually benefited from the slave trade just as much as the Americas, because Africans received guns in exchange for slaves. And I remember being so speechless. Like, I couldn't form a sentence. I remember opening my mouth in protest. My mouth just went dry because I knew in my gut and I knew in my head what she was telling me was wrong, but I didn't have the language to express it. And that's why the campaign is so important to me, because I don't want another black or brown child to feel that powerless ever again.
And what comes next for Fill in the Blanks? And then I want to hear what comes next for IC3.
Yeah, so right now we're really trying to engage with teachers and policymakers. We have a meeting set up with Nick Gibb, who's Minister for School Standards. And we're excited for the meeting, and we're willing to work with anyone who's willing to speak with us. We want this to be a policy that the Conservatives are proud of, in the same way that they're proud of the fact that gay marriage was legalised during their tenure.
And so what's next, Seema, for
IC3? Yeah. So currently many of us are in full-time education, so we'll be sitting our A-level exams, stressed, worried. But we have something big planned. We'll take these 6 months to regroup, decide on what we want to do. If I tell you, I might have to kill you.
Right, okay, fair enough. You're keeping it under wraps. You're keeping it under wraps. So, Rochelle, tell us sort of, you've told us about the campaigns. You've told us how you got into the Advocacy Academy. What's the sort of learning around campaigning? What's the sort of biggest point of learning that you've taken, either to inform your campaign or more generally?
I think that there's two really big things I learned from advocacy. In terms of the action, I learned that flexibility is really, really good. And even if you don't like flexibility, sometimes you'll have no choice because there'll be a general election. And I think the other big thing that I learned from advocacy is that anger is really good. Because I think we teach young people to shy away from anger, and it's not something that we should embrace. But advocacy, so much of what we do is grounded in anger. Like, not like rage, like the type that makes you want to like punch a wall, but like cold anger. Like, because I think that cold anger is just the fuel for every movement for justice, because that feeling in your gut that something's wrong, but you need to do something about it.
Seema.
Yeah, so what I've taken from advocacy is there's a lot of unlearning the world needs to do. And by unlearning, I mean questioning societal traditional views in which we are told that, you know, this is how we're meant to grow up and this is how we're meant to be. I mean, in addition to this, like, hope is not really a strategy. Many of us hope for the best. We hope that things will change. But if you don't take action into your own hands, and if you don't do the research, and if you don't work for change, it will never happen.
Brilliant. God, I'm voting for you. We've got this thing on the podcast. Jeff's obviously not here, but it's called the Jeffocracy, which is the sort of... I don't think we really approve of this idea. And in fact, maybe the coup against this can now be sort of officially declared now, which is, it's this idea of Jeff as a sort of benign ruler. But let's say that he gave you complete free reign in the Jeffocracy. What would you do?
Okay, I think that I would want to be the Secretary for Education.
Yeah.
And boy, the things I would do. I think there's two big things I would do in my first day in office. The first one would be to mandate the teaching of colonial history.
Yeah.
Because I think it's important that we have an honest curriculum that encourages children to be critical. Because if we're not encouraging children to be critical, then why are we teaching them history? And I'd make sure that this applies not just to schools that have to follow the national curriculum, also to academies, independent schools and free schools, so that it applies to everyone. And the other thing would be, I'd really sit down and examine the pedagogical methods being used in the classroom, because one of the things about advocacy that makes us so different is the fact that we learn through simulations and games and arts and crafts, much to my dread, and also discussions. And I think it's important that when we're teaching something as sensitive as Empire, that we realise that not everyone can tolerate death by PowerPoint and having to stare at a textbook, and that when we're teaching something that's so foundational to our understanding of how Britain is today, we do it in the right way.
Great. Seema?
In my first day of office, I would fund more into schools, especially secondary schools, where children are being permanently excluded. So only 1% of permanently excluded children are actually attaining 5 good GCSEs. So I would fund more into schools so that schools could have at least 10 counsellors to the one police officer that they have, in order to provide for children who need the mental health support. Because if society is failing children, why should schools too?
Brilliant. Honestly, both of you, it's incredibly, you know, it's lots of people maybe feeling a little bit depressed, partly because it's January and partly for other reasons as well. But it's honestly incredibly inspiring to meet you both. Rochelle Meaden and Seema Mangal, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Now, listening to all that, and she did offer to leave the room, the offer was turned down, is Amelia Viney, who's the founder of the Advocacy Academy.
I am.
Feeling very proud.
I am very proud. I'm very proud of them. They did beautifully.
Tell us your story about the Advocacy Academy. You set it up. How did it come about?
You know, the Academy is a continuation of what has been quite a beautiful history of youth activism, but not so much in this country, if we're being real. The Academy is, at its heart, a social justice youth movement. It's an activist training program for young people who have the lived experience of the issues they're trying to fight. And we're serious about making sure that they can win those battles. But much of what we're founded off is the American Civil Rights Movement. In the 1960s, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which is quite a mouthful, SNCC, they built this very agitational youth movement that it was the 1960s Civil Rights Act that was basically because of the sit-ins that they led that they managed to get the 1965 Voting Rights Act.
Yeah.
And these kids, they were 18, 19 years old. They were sitting in lunch counters. And what was so interesting about those movements is they weren't 25, they were 18, 19. But what was even more exciting is that they were founded on a platform of political education. The Freedom Schools, Mississippi Freedom School in particular, are these incredible educational programs for kids that didn't have a very good academic upbringing that taught them the truth about how to be critical and exactly what Seema was talking about, how to unlearn what society had taught them so that they could change it. So we are bringing much of that learning. And the Highlander School that trained Rosa Parks is the same modules that we're teaching these kids. It's just new to this country and this generation.
And tell us about your story, Amelia. What's your history?
I was serving as a researcher in Westminster at the time that you were leader.
Right.
And before that, I was a lobbyist in Congress.
Right.
And I was an activist as a kid. I came up through activism.
In the United States?
No, in England. I came up in activism in Kingston.
Right.
But there's this interesting thing of being, I was in Kingston in the 2000s, and it was not an intersectional time for activism, right? We were doing fair trade work and Darfur work. It was important. But the truth is that my understanding of power at the time in particular was
was big P power. It was the power of going into Westminster and Congress. And I did it. And I really thought, this is where I'm going to make change. I'm going to go and I'm going to make serious change. And you know what it was like.
Me too,
you
yeah.
were there. It was a really difficult time. The reality of being in Westminster in 2012 is that most people look like us. And it is, and I'm a woman, so you know, that's yeah. a positive. But the reality is, I lived in Stockwell, and I had been a youth worker for a long time, and I'd been building programs with experiential pedagogy for a long time. And I thought, wow, the people with lived experience of these issues are not anywhere near the decision-making power. They can see Westminster from their schools, but they've never been there in any meaningful way except for to look at Westminster Hall. And that's terrifying. The people who understand the implications of the policies that we're making are nowhere near those rooms. And I thought, okay, we have an issue in this country where we have incredible youth workers who across 10 years have been depoliticized. And then on the other side, we have these activists who have no idea how to work with kids. None. They have no idea how to safeguard kids doing direct action. And more than that, kids with lived experience, they don't know how to support them, because when you tap into the pain of doing this work, you need support. So we thought, okay, I can sit in the middle of this. I can make a program that is pedagogically beautiful and engages young people who don't have academic backgrounds. And then I also can really win, right? That's the one thing that it teaches you. You go into Westminster, you know how power really works, barefaced, not how it pretends to. So the program was designed to bring the worlds of youth work and activism together. And we're not a youth program. We're not a youth club. We're an activist movement that works with young people because they are the right age to bring the hope necessary, but also the real chops for it. They have a pretty high risk tolerance, young people, to change the world.
And you've been going 5 years or so?
Yeah, it'll be 6 in February.
And how many graduates? How do you feel it's going?
We're going to hit 115 this February.
115?
Yeah.
And how is it? It's about 20 a year, yeah?
Yeah, that's about right.
And how is it going?
My expectation was non-existent. I was pretty angry about what I saw in Westminster.
Yeah.
And there was a problem. 2010, it brought up a lot of great activism, but it was frenetic. It was not particularly well directed. It was desperate in many ways. And we weren't training people. I mean, if you want to go and be a great activist, activism is a skill. It's a muscle you have to train. Where do you go in this country? Where do you learn how to be a good activist? It's like, there's nowhere to be. And so we wanted to create a freedom school that would do that. Has it exceeded my expectations? Yeah, it's transformed them. I mean, we have young people in our program who have won incredible things that...
Give us some examples of your past graduates.
Sure. How many alumni am I allowed to shout out? I think, here's a couple of examples. So let's take the CLT campaign. We had an issue of affordable housing in South London that meant that basically no kids were able to stay in the community unless they live with their parents. A lot of them were in overcrowded council homes. Those young people kept saying to us, you know, we want to build houses. And I said, surely you want more council housing. And these 18-year-old kids with nothing to their name said, you seriously think I want to get up every day in order to fight for more council homes? I want to own my house. I deserve to own my own home. So they built this campaign for a community land trust, the first youth-led community land trust in the country. And they won a £5 million piece of land from TfL in Streatham. And they are going through the planning process. Wow. And it will have a quota of those homes for under 25-year-olds from the community.
Wow.
That is an incredible campaign run by JP and Costa. Then we have Latin Excluded, these three young Latin American women who are totally invisible in our society. We don't talk about our Latin American community. And they knew that. So what they said is, how do we get more investment? And the interesting truth is that to get investment, you need data. You have to prove that there is an inequality. And there wasn't even data for them to use and say, like the African American community in the States did, give us programs, we deserve them. So they have in the last 2 years worked with Citizens UK to get data collection for the first time from Lambeth Council as a council and from King's University as the first university. And they will use that data to prove the need for investment in Latin American kids. I mean, I can give you 15 campaigns that are currently running. And I honestly to God believe that the current conversations around exclusion and isolation are because of both IC Free and our campaign last year, who are no lost causes. They have been to speak to the Education Select Committee. They have given evidence to Southwark Council. These kids are not kidding. And that is why I am so proud of the things that they've achieved.
I'm incredibly persuaded. I'm very struck. You mentioned Citizens UK. Mm-hmm. I was very struck talking to Rochelle and Seema that it spoke to, after the 2015 general election, I went on this 5-day Citizens UK training.
Yep.
And I was very struck that it sort of spoke to a lot of that learning.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of based on this community organising.
It very idea. Much is. The heart of the Advocacy Academy is a community organizing and creative campaigning model. So I was trained by the IAF in Chicago, the same people that trained Obama.
And Arnie Graf. Who
and Arnie Graf and Michael Gekin, exactly. And it completely transformed my understanding of how justice needs to be done. Mobilizing has its place, but if mobilizing could change the world, we wouldn't have student fees and we wouldn't have the war in Iraq. The reality is that a relational model that doesn't build just for one battle, that builds relationships for 50, 60, 70 years, I expect these kids to show up for each other when they are retired, to fight for better social care. That is the way that change is going to happen. And it sounds ridiculous, but the truth is that some of the most incredible transformations in our society have come through organizing, and yet it's this sort of unspoken about force that happens undercover. And that needs to change. We need organizing to become mainstream.
So you've had extraordinary success with your 115 graduates in 5 years, or coming up for 6 years. The sort of thing I feel most of all, and I suspect our listeners will feel this too, is yes, 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 we want more of this everywhere. Yes, how? What's your plan for world domination?
Oh, God, that's a complicated question. It's funny, I have a different answer every day to that question. Right. It's very clear that the kids are hungry for this. We only allow applications from South London. And we have this year alone had applications from every region in this country, from the Northeast, from South Africa. It's a real problem that we have chosen to be this hyper-local youth movement authentically in our community. We have 400 people coming to graduation. There is clearly a lack of opportunity because we are filling a gap that we are not designed to fill. This cannot be another situation where a good idea that is run effectively and authentically then scales and ruins itself, right? That's what NCS did. It was a mess. The truth is...
That's the National Citizen Service.
Yes. And it was a beautiful idea, right? To give kids access to meaningful programming, to give them a communal language. It was a great idea. But in doing it en masse, what happened is that it wasn't targeted and it wasn't bespoke. And every good youth program is targeted and bespoke. I have no right to show up to Grimsby and to tell them how they should organize their kids. I live in Stockwell. It's my community, and that's why I organize there.
Right.
So the way the Academy is dealing with this, which is slightly unusual, is we want to be a center of excellence, a bit like the Harlem Children's Zone did. It was a pretty spectacular model. They didn't leave Harlem. They judged themselves on the efficacy of the Harlem community year on year. We want to build the power of our community. But we've founded this program called Just Education, which is essentially us giving away our model. We want to say, if you are an activist or a youth worker and you're willing to develop the other side of that skill and you want to come down and see how we do our work, we will train you in it and we'll send you back up so that you can take the model and then make it relevant to the kids that you're living with. Because we have 400 activists who work with us. You know who doesn't have that? Grimsby, not even Hull. They would have to bring them from London, and that's not a model I think is sustainable. So each area needs to figure out what is right for its kids. And, you know, I got to shout out to some people who are trying to do that. Beat Freaks are really working to bring the arts version of that into Birmingham, and you have Reclaim in Manchester who are absolutely crushing it, and there's MAP in Norfolk trying to make that work for those kids, but none of those models are the same. So they all come down, they meet us, they hang out with us, they see our kids, they learn from us, but I have no intention of being as patronizing as we have been for many years and saying that London has the answers. I have the answers for South London, and it's a pleasure to do the work with the kids that I live with. I know their streets they grew up in, I know the schools they go to, I can spot them on the bus in their school uniforms, and that is how it should be.
Okay. Before we end, I've got to ask you, if you want to apply, who's eligible, how and when do they apply by? If you know somebody who might want to do it, then people want to pass on details. And if you aren't living in South London, but you want to set up this model, how do you go about sort of getting in touch and all that?
This is actually the perfect day to ask that question. Applications open on the 1st of January. And so any young person who is between the ages of about 16 and 18, and that is vague because we have always got exceptions every single year, kids who have left education but are still kind of trying to figure out their lives, young people. Yeah, right.
Can I apply?
Hello. But yeah, you can certainly come and teach. We'd love to have
you. Elastic definition, 16 to 18.
If you are of that age-ish and you are angry about injustice and inequality and you want to create a more fair, just, and equal world, you have to live or go to school in South London. And yes, for those of you that try and pretend that Surrey is South London, I'm not talking to you.
Right.
You have to have SW or SE as your postcode for school or for your house. But what's crucial about this is we work with kids who sit at the intersection of multiple oppressions. So if you're someone that's done lots of this work, then it might not be that this is the program for you.
The big thing we're looking for is anger and potential. So if you're the kid who's listening to this and thinking, there's no way they would take me, we probably are looking for you.
Okay. And if other people who are not in South London but are interested in the model, what do they do?
They should get in touch with us. We are...
Through your website?
Through our website. Through, we have a lot of social media presence, mainly because young people love that. But for us, if they want to tweet us or Instagram us, or please don't Snapchat us. I have no idea how to check my Snapchat.
Yeah.
But if they actually get in touch in any way, we're gonna bring them in and we're going to say, what is it that you can offer? What do you love? And let's figure out a way to do that together.
I want to live in the Ameliocracy, I think. I know you're against the Ameliocracy principle. Amelia Viney, thank you so much for joining
us. It's a total pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's been very fun.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
And now to hear about another brilliant project, Reclaim, based in Greater Manchester. We're joined by Olivia Clark, who's a young person involved in Reclaim and the recent If We Did This campaign, and Katie Cosgrave, who's a senior program manager at Reclaim. Reclaim is an organisation that works to amplify the voices of working class young people in Greater Manchester. Thanks so much to you both for joining us.
It's fine. Thank you for having us.
So, Olivia, let's start with you. You've been involved in Reclaim for a number of years. Can you tell us your story of how you first got involved in the project and your experience with it since?
Yes. So I was 11 when I joined Reclaim, and they came into our school and presented who they were, what their aim was. So during my half term, I spent a week with them where they helped me to really educate myself on the current political situation at the time.
What year was that, Olivia?
2014.
Right.
And really just the social issues that young people face and how, like, encouraged us to express our opinions and get our voices heard and provide us with opportunities to do so. And then ever since then, I'm now 17, I've been involved with Reclaim. I've spoken the Commons, I've done many different things, and that's with Reclaim support and given me the opportunity to, I knew I had a voice, but not how to use it. I never was really given the opportunities by my school to use my voice.
And you're currently part of the If We Did This campaign. Tell us, which was, I think, a campaign at the general election. What's the campaign about and what have you been calling for?
The campaign was born off the back of, we didn't really like the way we were being represented and still don't appreciate nor like the way we're represented in the Commons, especially through the body language, the language used. We don't feel represented as working class young people of different racial, religious and different genders. We don't feel represented. And so we thought we'd come together with the If We Did This campaign to tackle that and show these politicians that are supposed to be making decisions on our futures that we want to be represented in the correct way. Because if we were to do this in a classroom, we'd be sent out, there would be consequences for us. So why is it that because they're adults in power, why shouldn't they be held accountable and, well, yeah, face consequences because of it?
And that's not just about the thing that often people talk about, which is the sort of yaboo of the House of Commons. It's really about the language that people in politics use. And what reaction have you had to your campaign?
Overall, it has been really positive. We've had 68,724 people sign our petition. So just that support as well has been amazing. And it's been positive overall.
And where does it go next, do you think?
We've got so many different branches of things we could go for, like getting politics into the education system, monitoring and improving class diversity of election candidates, and getting more working class young people's voices into policy making. So there's lots of different routes we could take. We just are coming together next week to kind of look at that next destination.
That's incredibly inspiring, Olivia. Katie, tell us about the story behind Reclaim and what the organisation is trying to achieve.
Yeah, absolutely. So, first of all, the you know, we're here to end class inequality. You know, in practice, that is people not being held back by their background. Background should be seen as a source of strength, not discriminated against. So we support working class young leaders, we support their campaigns for change, and we work with organisations to be inclusive of working class talent. So Reclaim started in 2007. The founder, Ruth Ibeg-Buna, was a teacher in Mosside, and she was just fed up of the rhetoric. I don't know if you know Mosside, but it's you know, in Manchester, it had such a bad reputation, people would call it. It, you know, the name Gunchester came from that, and there was lots of things going on there. But she knew differently. She knew that the young people there were eloquent, were bright and challenging. So she worked with 30 young leaders, and she created the LEAD campaign, which is about getting young people to look at leadership, social enterprise, community development and activism. The work started in 2007 in Mosside, and it was working with predominantly black males because of the stigma, the media, that the representation that was around at the time. And as we dug deeper into that, and as we looked at how we worked with those young people, it was only a couple of years later that we really started to see that the problem that we were always facing was class. It was about working class communities. So even though, say, for example, in Lee, which is predominantly white, they are still a working class community that we'll work with, but they'll face a lot of different issues than, say, an area like Mosside, which have lots of people of colour, which will face a different set of working class issues. I think we see class as... you know, we think about class when as like men in caps mining. Class isn't that what it was then. It isn't that today. Class can be, there's a few ways we talk about class. You know, your economic capital, so your access to income and wealth and support. Your social capital, so that's who you know, so who's around you, who can get you in those rooms, and cultural capital, so your ability to fit in with the cultures around you. I think as we worked more with those communities, we realised that that was the thing that brought all those together. Working class was something that actually bridged all those different issues.
How many young people have you managed to sort of involve in your campaigns?
Over the years, we've worked with, there's been hundreds and hundreds over the years. What we tend to do is we go into a school and we work with the whole of a year group, but then we will have maybe 30 that we will select from an area that will then focus and create a manifesto for change from their area. So then it's kind of like they're leading their community and the other young people in the area.
And Olivia, tell us, what kind of response have you had from public authorities, politicians? Anyone you'd single out for praise, positive response?
I think for me personally, Andy Burnham, he's a very good representation of a politician, person in power that's listened to a young person. So back in 2016, I think it was, I went to one of his... campaign meeting sort of things in Bury College and expressed that I think there should be more young people involved in what he's doing, and particularly something to do with free travel for young people so they can access these kind of meetings and get involved with these political conversations. And then since then, the RPAS has been introduced in Greater Manchester for 16 to 18-year-olds to get
free travel, is it, for young
people?
Yeah,
it's free travel for young people, which, like, looking at it, it's like, wow, people, when it's not just for me to show me that my voice can make a difference, but it should be an example to all people in power that if you listen to the young people, then something positive will come out of it.
What are the other things that Reclaim is campaigning on that you'd like to highlight?
So we, all our campaigns are youth-led, so it's whatever the young people come up with. We've just had a brilliant campaign from the Boys from Lee, which is a group of 12 and 13 year old boys that is, it's called Talk to Us and Stay with Us. And they were campaigning on suicide prevention for young males. They hosted a lads night in, which was fantastic. They got loads of people from the community together, and they just talked about things and talked about issues because they felt there was a stigma around men
at
talking
12
about
and 13
things. Yeah, at 12 and 13, they hosted the whole thing. The staff were literally just there to do the little jobs, handing out food, doing that kind of stuff. They hosted it all. It was absolutely fantastic. And they're really passionate about toxic masculinity. So they're pushing for that. We've got Full-Time Fierce, which is a leadership program for young female working class women who have been, they've created a podcast, Smashing the Hierarchy, where they're interviewing different leaders, changers. We've got those two running at the moment. And then If We Did This campaign, which we are focusing on now to see where we can take this next.
We've got a thing on the podcast called the Jeffocracy, which is basically the rule of a out of touch white male, so it doesn't really speak to this agenda, but just sort of set that to one side and feel free to be sort of launching a coup against it because Jeff's not here. If you both were ministers for whatever you liked under the Jeffocracy, what's the sort of first thing you do on day one in office?
I would encourage more young people, more just in a sense diversity across the board, in terms of different genders, encouraging more women, racial diversity, religious diversity, just seeing a more representative body when it comes to talking about issues that are going to affect specifically young people's futures.
And I would instantly put politics on the curriculum so that every high school had to teach politics, so that young people aren't getting to voting age and just not having a relationship with it.
And is it your experience, Katie, that a lot of the young people are not properly learning politics?
Absolutely. The conversations I have with young people, we are their entrance into it. And the majority of young people that stay with us and campaign with us, they actually take it at A level. So it's not that they're not interested, it's that they're not taught about it and they don't know it's there. I myself remember getting to voting age and thinking, I don't know what I'm doing. Oh, what do my parents vote for? Rather than looking at the facts, looking at what I believed or I thought, we need to have that critical thinking discussion to take place in schools at an early age so that they can really form their own thoughts and think about what it is that they want to see.
Okay, very inspiring to talk to you. Olivia Clark and Katie Cosgrave, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, what do I think? I think that was a sort of remarkable and inspiring conversation, but mainly because of the young people that we talked to and what they are doing. I think it emphasises a number of things. It emphasises the importance of the Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, I don't think this is her original phrase, but you can't be what you can't see. And the notion that, politics needs to look a lot more like the country, and the extent to which young people think it rightly still doesn't look like the country. I think the fact that, everyone can make a difference, that it's what the community organizing course I did after the 2015 general election taught me, that, yes, people feel powerless, but it doesn't mean that they have no power, no ability to change things and to start to make a difference if they have the tools to do so. And I guess thirdly, very strikingly about the Advocacy Academy, that I think they've got a very good engagement with power. They understand sort of power and power dynamics, and that you need to, you can't just assume away those dynamics, just to ask for nice things and hope they happen, that you have to think, what's your strategy to engage with that power? And it feels to me like both organizations are really thinking that through and have got important successes. And at a time when lots of people can feel hopeless, I thought it was a really, really optimistic set of conversations.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, we're in the outro and I can officially announce that the Jeffocracy is over. We're actually recording the episode in his house. Jeff is not here. I think that counts as a sort of, you know, takeover of the means of communication, which is what happens in military coups. This is not a military coup. It's a totally bloodless coup, but it is the end of the Jeffocracy. We can sort of declare it over, at least temporarily, until he sort of returns from the country. He shouldn't have gone on holiday. That's the other lesson of coups. And I think this week's episode illustrated why, you know, the sort of Jeffocracy of the leadership of Jeff is totally inappropriate. I'd like to thank Rochelle Meaden, Seema Mangal, Amelia Viney, Olivia Clark, and Katie Cosgrave. Emma Corsham produced the podcast with backup and research from Joel Pierce and Joe Kenyon. Ed Seed produced our music. James Deacon did our idents. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. Our artwork is not done by Emily Power, but by Henry Cull. Jeff will be back next week, but in the meantime, he's been ousted, I've been installed, and these have been Reasons to be Cheerful.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's GRAMMARLY.com/podcast. Easier said, done.